So there actually was a Phantom of the Opera that starred Robert Englund. And yeah. This got made in 1989.
I always thought it was
Englund. No, it was...
Robert, you said you thought it was Englund? Robert Englund.
That's...
It's Freddy Krueger.
That's not the same thing.
Freddy Krueger.
Freddy Krueger. Robert Englund stars as Freddy Krueger.
Whole grocery store.
Produce is over there, bitch. Hey, how about a pun and some great savings? Freddy Krueger.
Knives are in aisle 12.
Jesus Christ.
Robert Englund stars as Freddy Krueger.
No, they did.
What a fucking weird movie.
They did. He starred as Phantom of the Opera in a like reimagined slasher version.
That happened.
Yeah, it was really weird.
So it came out in 89, and this is a podcast unto itself, and that's Phantom of the Opera movies, because there have been so fucking many, and some of them are great, and some of them are insane, where they're just like, I don't know what it is about Phantom of the Opera, where they feel like it's a good idea to just mix mythologies together, where it's like in one film, they're like, oh yeah, it's Phantom of the Opera and Faust. Or it's Phantom of the Opera and the Picture of Dorian Gray together. Like, okay, wait, those have nothing to do with each other. Why would you do that? But this version of Phantom of the Opera that starred Robert Englund came out in 89. It starred Jill Sholin. She was Brad Pitt's girlfriend at the time. That was like one of her big claims to fame. And strangely enough, it starts in modern New York. So it starts in New York, 1989. Mm-hmm. Christine Day... because, you know, they can't say Daye. They're like, Christine Day is like a New York-like girl that's... she's like auditioning for a show. And Meg, right? The Meg character is played by Molly Shannon.
Yeah.
Which is strange. Mm. She's like superstar, but pre-superstar.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And she's Meg. And Christine Day is trying out on stage for a musical, for a play. And... somebody drops a piece of the set on her and it transports her to 1890s London.
Yeah, it's weird.
Where she becomes, you know, Christine Day of 1890s London.
Yeah, apparently even in the 1890s they can't say Daye.
Yeah, no, it's just Day. And they get around her not having an accent and being a generally bland actress by explaining, well, she's an American that's overseas in the London Opera House. Wait a second. Wasn't it the Paris Opera House?
Yes.
Nope, not in this one. Nope. It's the London Opera House.
They don't want anything French in this movie.
Nothing French.
You know what's funny? We've hit the ground running at almost 3 minutes here and have, like, we crash landed into the beginning of the Phantom of the Opera. Yeah, people are listening and like, what the fuck is this episode
about? It's so epically bad.
It's not good
at
all.
It's so epically bad, but it's kind of entertaining to watch.
Yeah.
You know? Anyway, I'm Mr. Agitator, lead singer-songwriter for V is for Villains.
I'm Fallon Flynn. I play guitars and do backup vocals.
Kizzy Chaos, synth and backup vocals.
That's right. She's also flame retardant.
She is.
So
only on days that end in Wednesday.
So we're lucky because we get back-to-back episodes with Kizzy, you know?
That's true.
The whole band is here.
We need more Kizzy in our lives.
Yeah, we do.
It's amazing. So today's topic... is Wes Craven, master horror filmmaker Wes Craven, the late great Wes Craven.
Yes, so instead of doing a film...
I always thought it was Craven.
Craven?
Wes Craven created Craven. Freddy Krueger, played by Robert Englund. And yet,
so
somehow this is a documentary I would watch. I'd be like, I want to learn about Freddy Krueger.
Be like, I believe this man has never seen a horror movie in his life.
What's crawling?
Christina Day.
Christina Day. And yet we all have that friend who mispronounces shit and tries to make it super fancy, you know? And it's horrible every time. Oh, your name is Cassie? Cassie.
Aaron.
Aaron. It's horrible.
So instead of doing a focus on there's one movie like we typically kind of have done or in like even years past when
this
we did
this is
it.
The director episode.
Yeah, we're just kind of talking more about Wes Craven and all the cool shit he did.
Very interesting guy. His career started later, actually. He didn't really get started in filmmaking proper. And I think he was like in his early 40s. You know, so whereas how most filmmakers, they kind of nurture that passion at a young age. He had like a family, like a wife and like kids. And I think he was at the time he was like a teacher or a professor. And, you know, he was just like, you know what I want to do? I want to make movies, man. I want to go and make movies. And everyone was like, well, you can't. You're a teacher and you have a family. He was just like, fuck you. I'm just going to leave my family. And he kind of did. And he decided he was going to go make films. And, you know, his first film, like first major film, was Last House on the Left, you know, which is a masterpiece in horror cinema. It is equal parts horrible and equal parts
horrifying.
Yeah. Right. You know, like, I can't tell you. It's like, have you ever seen it, Kizzy?
I feel like I have, but I might be confusing it with something else in my head.
Vicious rape scenes, vicious violence.
Yeah.
And to this day, it still holds. Like, it's one of those films that I still watch today and I get uncomfortable.
Is it the one where these two guys come up to the house and they need help, quote, quote?
Yeah, somewhat.
And then they just stay in there and just ransack the place and so, torture them. And
kind of. No, no. So Last House on the Left is based in part, I believe, in a German or maybe a Norwegian fairy tale. I don't remember which it is. But and as we'll learn as we dissect Wes Craven's career a little bit more, he has a knack for kind of taking old fairy tales or old stories and reinterpreting them.
Yeah, taking them. The fucked up things that happened and modernizing the fucked
right.
up.
Which yeah. is brilliant because, you know, those stories have existed for a reason because they're great. So in Last House on the Left, one of his the first big film, Sean Cunningham was the producer, right? And he was the director. Now, who is Sean Cunningham? He went on to create Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. So he created Jason Voorhees, Pamela Voorhees. And interestingly enough, the main character, the main killer, the main bad guy, his name is Krug. And he wields a machete. So he's this odd pre-Freddy Krueger and an odd pre-Jason Voorhees kind of archetypal character there. You know, he went by Krug. Not Krogue. Krug. So in the film, you have these two young girls. They're like in their late teens. They want to go to the like city and see a band or something. And they buy drugs off some guy. They're going to buy drugs, marijuana. So they end up, the guy like is this kid. He's like in his late teens, early 20s. And he kind of invites them upstairs. Hey, you know, come smoke with me, you know, or whatever. And they're like, okay. And they realize when they go upstairs, they're in a really bad fucking situation. There's this crazy chick and like two other adult, like older guys. And, like, immediately it escalates from, oh, well, this could be bad, to they're getting raped and beaten. And then they take them out to the woods. They torture the girls over, like, the next hour of the film, which is brutal to watch, honestly.
I mean, and you talk about, for the time, you know, the movie itself, there's a lot of things about it that are hokey. It's not a particularly great movie when you go back and watch certain aspects of it.
It's very uneven.
Yeah, but the moments that were intense, that were intended to be uncomfortable, they're definitely still uncomfortable. And now, anybody that listened to our Halloween episode, we talked about how Halloween pioneered certain things, you know, in the time that it was released. This predates Halloween. This movie was released in 1972.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is older, you know. And I mean, this is the early 70s, you know, when you don't see a lot of this style of movie out.
Right.
And so this movie is often credited for having a lot of influence on the direction of slashers with a character like Krug. Right. He kind of sets up some of that
what
stuff
would
too.
End up becoming that archetype. Yeah. So you have two seminal horror films that predate Halloween and are after Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho, right in the sweet spot in between, and that's Last House on the Left, and then right after Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
That's right.
Now, Texas Chainsaw Massacre really pushed the envelope, but it was Halloween that mainstreamed it. That was when it became a huge box office mainstream success. And as we know, the money and the influence is what determines the victor of the era. So whereas how a character like Leatherface, though terrifying, and if you ever watched the original Texas Chainsaw, it's still considered terrifying and it's very uncomfortable to watch.
Brutal.
It's brutal. It's brutal in the weirdest way. Mm-hmm. It's very psychological.
Yeah, it is.
So, you know, Halloween took that and it mainstreamed it and it popularized it. But these two films set next to each other, Last House on the Left and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, by now two late directors, Wes Craven and Toby Hooper.
Yeah.
And the thing is, with those two filmmakers, man, people thought they were pariahs. Like, they were like pariahs. They were like psychos. People were like, oh, those guys are psychos. Like, no one could make a film like this and not be insane.
And Tobe Hooper would be kind of dogged until the end of his days as being a strange guy or, you know, really difficult guy.
But he also made Poltergeist.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love Poltergeist.
And it is. It's a great film.
If there's this little clip somewhere floating around out there, I'm sure you can find it on YouTube, but there's this little interview with Zelda Rubinstein, who played, what the hell is her name from Poltergeist? This house is clear.
Yeah,
there you go.
Yeah!
With the fucking assist.
So we should be doing a Poltergeist.
Yeah, we should. Well, she said, she did an interview where she says in a clip somewhere that how unpleasant and how uncomfortable Tobe Hooper used to make her. She's just like, that man made me uncomfortable. I didn't like being around him. Because he was on drugs the whole time he was.
Oh yeah, filled, yeah.
He had a pretty well known reputation for being
drug addict.
Pretty hyped up, pretty hyped up while he was filming. It's and she's bad. Like he was like belligerent and like always on edge and very very hard to work for. And she's like, I loved doing those movies, but I did not like being.
Imagine taking direction like that on the set of Texas. So here's what's gonna happen. The guy, he's gonna come in. He's gonna fucking chainsaw. He's just gonna wrap up that fucking chainsaw. He's like, my God, where's my fucking heroin?
Yeah.
Did you get the notes from that? No.
I think it was a paraphrase where she was just like, I didn't like being in the same room as that man. I didn't like Jesus that man. Christ. It was something like that. And I remember going, damn, man, that speaks volumes if like little tiny Zelda Rubinstein.
I did not like being in the room with that man. He made me so uncomfortable. And he left and I said, this room is clear.
This is horrible. But in contrast to that horrible reputation, Wes Craven was known as a genius, a very polite gentleman. And he was like a very, in contrast, I've got some clips that I'll actually play throughout the podcast of the Robert Englund interview that I recorded at Mad Monster Party this year in February. But he talks about Wes Craven a little bit, and we'll roll a clip. And as you can hear, what he's saying there is kind of like, wow, he was this kind of very dressed down, kind of polo shirt wearing, you know, clean cut gentleman. Which is a very interesting contrast to the stories that he tells. Because this is psychotic shit. Like, when you get down to Last House on the Left, then the film he followed that up with, The Hills Have Eyes, mm-hmm. about, it, once again, That's a film awesome. Steeped in rape and murder and just the worst transgressions imaginable by man. Then you cap it off with Nightmare on Elm Street, which, when you go back to its basic, the core of that film, it's about a child rapist.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's a terrifying film. The original is terrifying, it's uncomfortable, and it should be. You know, this is before Freddy Krueger was popularized and became Freddy Kroger. This is back when he was still actually Fingy Knives terrifying Freddy Krueger.
The thing with it is if you look at where Wes Craven started, and you go from Last House on the Left to The Hills Have Eyes to Nightmare on Elm Street, this is a man that over time is taking the things that didn't work about his movies and shaving that off, just trimming the fat out of them.
Learning the art.
And taking the things that did work that made people uncomfortable and tuning it. Because Nightmare on Elm Street is incredibly uncomfortable, but it's not...
Yes.
It's not straight up like
unwatchable
rape scenes where you're just, it makes your skin crawl.
Right. He had found a classier way to tell the same story.
Yeah.
You know, and in that note, we're going to get into some shit with the Scream series that is absolutely incredible by comparison and how ahead of his time he was. Really smart guy, really provocative filmmaker. But an interesting juxtaposition to his professional image. And, you know, Cassie and I were talking about this earlier before we started recording the podcast. You know, it's kind of funny that when you make art to some extent, people associate you with that artistic statement as if it's autobiographical, when it's not necessarily. You know, like, I'm sure if you're listening, you're familiar with Vias for Villains, you're familiar with Digital Mindy and the work that I've written and some of the things that I write about. And, you know, it's funny to me that sometimes people kind of think that a song, for instance, like Broken Doll, it's like, you know, I'll have people tell me sometimes, you know, wow, yeah, that would have... What a terrible message in that song, or like, what a angry song. And I'm like, yeah. I'm like, agree with them. I stand there, I'm just like, yeah, who, the guy in that song is a prick. And they're like, well, it's you. And I'm like, no, it's not. That's not me.
Yeah.
You know, there's a difference between that being my personal point of view and a story that I'm telling.
Look, if the writers of tales and stories were held accountable for the stories that they write as if it were the actions of themselves in their lives, every writer on the planet would be in jail.
Well, it's insane to me. The thing that I think is hilarious is, you know, people, I think because it's music, they associate a personal connection because it's an intimate setting, usually. You're listening on earphones or headphones or whatever by yourself to an album, and you're hearing my voice say to you directly, you know, I'm gonna fucking burn your house down, or whatever. So, and I think it kind of connects with people in that way. Well, Nick said he's gonna burn my house down. You know.
And I remember the time you burned my house down.
That's what you fucking get. Don't you forget it! You know? But my point is, nobody goes up to, like, you know, the guy who writes Law and Order. And it's just like, so tell me about the case that you cleared on so-and-so. Or nobody goes up to the director of Silence of the Lambs and is like, what do people taste like?
You know, that's like, what I'm saying. You know, you can think of anything awful that's been written.
Do you recommend a certain brand of lotion?
That's right. What's the lotion that goes on the skin?
And if I can put it on my skin, what hose were you using to give it to them again?
Is it going to have a nice faucet to the hose? I mean, yeah. Like, is there different settings?
Yeah.
Well, it's true. There's this kind of barrier where people sometimes have a weird way of not being able to discern fact and fiction. And you're kind of like, no. I like to think of the songs that I write and the stuff, the media that I put out there, as their own little horror movies or their own little horror stories or their own little Alfred Hitchcock Presents. You know, it's like they're their own little terrifying tales of wonder. So, you know, in my mind, I'm kind of a reporter on the human condition in an artistic way. I'm not sitting there going like, oh, and this was about that time that I beat that woman to death. You know what I mean?
Well,
like,
and that's where it applies to Wes Craven is that exactly. A lot of people would kind of take these movies and all of these terrible things he wrote earlier in his career and be like, guy's a fucking maniac.
He's a maniac. This guy couldn't have done this.
Yeah, but when you see later in his career, like he was very public about, he's like, if I had my way, I would have been writing love stories.
Right.
But nobody, he said, I tried to pitch some stuff like that.
Nobody wanted
and
it.
Nobody would buy it from nobody me because it. I'm Wes Craven, the master of horror.
Right.
And they didn't
and
give a shit about anything
else.
And
the name is just built for it. Wes Craven. You know?
It's Craven.
Wes Craven.
Yes.
Presents a nightmare on Umstritt.
Is that the Norwegian version of nightmare on Umstritt?
Yeah, a nightmare on Umstritt.
Yeah.
Starring Freddy Krueger. I don't know what accent that was.
Yeah, that's not any accent.
That's, I made that up.
Yeah,
clearly. But you know, so you get into the Nightmare on Elm Street phase. The guy had just come off of Swamp Thing. Little known fact: he directed Swamp Thing, which is in fucking.
It's mesmerizing for all the wrong reasons.
So bad,
like, but, so bad, it's good.
But I will say, to Wes Craven's credit, he knew it was a turd. You can tell in his filmmaking that he knew this was not going to win any awards. He was like, hey, we're making money. We're making Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
Good for us.
I'll never forget the first time I saw Swamp Thing. Nick and I had this remarkable youth where we spent a substantial portion of our childhood just watching everything, movies that came out.
Some of things we probably shouldn't have
Shouldn't have seen. Yeah, look, I remember seeing you know, the scene in Goodfellas where Robert De Niro bashes a dude's head in with a baseball bat. When that released, I couldn't have been any older than probably 6.
It's fine. So Robert England is an actor in his late 30s, I believe. You know, he's on the television show V. I think it is. You know, if you remember, that was a sci-fi show from like the 80s, 90s, or early 80s.
Yeah, which got a remake in I think the like late 2000s.
Yeah, yeah, he was on that. So, you know, he gets called in for an audition. He goes in. Per his words, he said he kind of took some. I think he went in actually with Jackie Earle Haley. He and Jackie Earle Haley went in at the same time. which is interesting. And I think Jackie Earle Haley read for Johnny Depp's part, the part of Glenn that Johnny Depp ended up taking, which is interesting because, as we would know, in 2010, Jackie Earle Haley would play Freddy Krueger. Which is a weird kind of wraparound. So, you know, he goes in, he meets Wes Craven, he says they connect pretty well in that he gets cast to play Freddy Krueger. Which is interesting because Freddy Krueger was a character that was supposed to be in his 60s. He wasn't supposed to be younger, he's supposed to be old. Like old, dirty,
like hobo
guy.
Type, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is why half the time they portray him like a dirty old hobo when you don't see him directly.
A wisecracking hobo.
When he's running through the alley with his like arm, you know, claws up.
It's a pretty visceral film, the original, and it's pretty great.
It is.
And they pull off some incredible effects moments.
Look, the first two Nightmare on Elm Street movies are achievements in discomfort.
Now the
for
second,
different reasons.
The second film is super interesting. Are you familiar with it, Cassie?
It's been a long time. I definitely saw Johnny Depp. I think as a kid when I saw it, because it's been that long.
Yeah.
I did see the release, the re-release.
The remake,
yeah.
But it was the only movie that I was actually afraid of because everything else is like, oh, that's not real. But this shit happens in your dreams.
Yeah,
and I sleep and I dream. You
look,
know?
I had more than one nightmare.
See the rest of them.
I had more than one nightmare about a Nightmare on Elm Street. See, you missed out on something though, because what happens is after the second one, they become progressively less scary and uncomfortable and more awkward and
so,
humorous.
I did see Freddy vs. Jason, and that was pretty humorous.
Freddy vs. Jason. It's
some
so
of the standalone Freddy movies before that were somehow
worse
than that.
So
like goofier.
We'll give a brief history really quick, and we'll go down that line.
Yep.
Wes Craven only directed two Nightmare on Elm Street films. He didn't do all of them.
No.
He did A Nightmare on Elm Street, which he wanted to cap off. He wanted that to be a standalone film.
And it watches like a standalone film.
It really does.
Which is great.
Robert Shea, the CEO of New Line at the time, fought him tooth and nail and said, okay, I got the financing for you to make this film. And it was made on a relatively low budget, I think, of around $900,000, which even back then wasn't a lot to make a feature. You know, so they were really gambling a lot. Now, that gamble paid off because it's the money from Nightmare on Elm Street profits that went into create Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, all the money that Nightmare on Elm Street made over the years is essentially what New Line Cinema used to bankroll the ungodly expense of the Lord of the Rings movies.
Yeah, so that's kind of an interesting cinema history there. Mm-hmm. And they actually called New Line Cinema the house that Freddy built for the longest time, which is located next to the Kroger, where Freddy Kroger works.
Jesus.
So sorry. So
a lot of people don't realize New Line Cinema was not actually a movie company.
It was a distribution company.
Yeah, they would do like instructional videos.
And Reefer Madness was another one that they did. Yep. They released Reefer Madness.
Actually, a lot of we're going to talk about the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, but I don't think we could get through this podcast talking about these things without recommending this unbelievable, if anybody really wants to dig into the entire history of A Nightmare on Elm Street, Never Sleep Again is a 4-hour documentary.
I think it came out in 2010.
Yeah.
And it's incredible.
And they get so many people from all of the movies. They sit down and interview a lot of the actors across the history of the movies and break down the details and information about the Nightmare on Elm Street series you didn't even know you wanted to know. But Nick and I watched it when it first came out. It's fucking mesmerizing. Like, once you start watching it, you can't stop. You learn so much about it. So we're touching on these today, but if you really want to go in depth, watch that. It is so fascinating.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah.
He
directed two of the movies.
He directed two of them. So he didn't do the entire series. He created the series. He came up with the concept, the character of Freddy Krueger, the character of Nancy, the final girl in the film, played by Heather Langenkamp. The first film sets up the world, sets up Freddy Krueger. It's a very straightforward film. The second film is gay. It's a gay horror film.
No, like super duper. And it's funny because it almost, if you watch it now, there's some really campy, funny shit in it.
There really is.
Let's be clear. This movie was never really intended to be, or at least at the time was not professed
so
to be
when I,
sort of very gay.
Mark Patton is the lead actor in the film, and in juxtaposition, there's a male playing the final girl role. which is kind of an interesting turn. And he plays it...
Jesse.
He's Jesse. He plays it with a certain feminine quality that still kind of washes over. Mm-hmm. When I spoke to Mark Patton about it, we met at Mad Monster Party 2017. When he and I spoke about it, by the way, thank you, Mark, for the signed script. He gave me a signed copy of the script, and it's beautiful. I love it. It's such a treasure for me. But when he and I chatted Nightmare 2 for a little while, you know, he told me that in his mind, he was pretty aware that they were making a gay film.
There are a lot of undertones. This has been discussed, you know,
he said that the
ad infinitum forever, you
right,
know.
Right. The film's director, Jack Shoulder, wasn't very aware. Like, he said that it kind of didn't cross Jack's mind that he was making a gay film. He's like, but most of the cast and crew, we knew we were making a mm-hmm. gay film. And, you know, and when you think about it, that's a pretty bold statement, especially at the time, you know. You're sitting in, like, what, the Reagan 80s? Like, that era where everything's very PC, mm-hmm. very Republican heavy, very, you know, anything gay is bad, anything, you know what I mean? And it was kind of a bold statement to make a film mm-hmm. that kind of went against those norms, you know, and especially in the horror community.
Yeah.
Because much like the token black character, the token gay character in a horror film had one job: show up, make a funny, witty remark, usually about what someone was wearing.
Yeah, be flamboyant.
And then get killed.
And then get killed.
Wait, no gratuitous sex scene?
No, yeah, no, that's gay, is what they would say back then. Oh,
nice. How do you like that, Dad?
Right.
Which is a line in the movie.
The gay character would show up, be like, oh no, those shoes don't work, get killed, and then look beautiful while they were dying.
Well, he got killed. Yeah.
There were a lot of strange tropes.
Right.
But the thing is what marks all of this stuff, if you've never seen the movie, sounds really over the top and kind of ridiculous for this movie at the time. But what is amazing about it is somehow the way they handle the sort of like thick layer of like sexual ambiguity in this movie somehow plays off of the discomfort that they build around the horror aspect of the movie. The movie is really uncomfortable. There are scenes in that movie that are so fucking uncomfortable.
Well, I feel like, you know...
Can you reenact them for us?
I look over, he's wearing leather.
Yeah,
like, John, what are you doing? I guess the thing is really the plot of the second film is Freddy Krueger is inside of Jesse and he's coming out of him. So they almost do this weird parallel of Freddy Krueger being the gay inside of a man,
uh-huh.
and the only redemption is to find love with a woman, which is strange. And like I said, somehow this film works.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's endlessly entertaining to watch when you put it in that light. You're kind of like, oh, wow, what a strange message. But I guess what would be more uncomfortable than not knowing yourself?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's the message that is kind of pushing along there. I don't know if they intended it for it to be, but it works.
But this one, wholly different, very different than the first movie.
Very different.
It's psychological. I think it's more psychological than visceral. But
yeah,
there are some really uncomfortable, like, visual and audio sort of presentations of this movie. Like, it's so, the sound in Nightmare on Elm Street 2 is so important. Some of the camera
yeah.
angles they use are
yeah.
really important. Some of the lighting they use is just so uncomfortable. Like, they just did a really good job in the scenes where
yeah.
they were trying to make you uncomfortable in Nightmare on Elm Street 2. Very uncomfortable.
You have said uncomfortable. Like,
it's because it's a fucking
time.
I'm getting a little uncomfortable.
I'm uncomfortable.
Uncomfortable.
It feels very uncomfortable.
Yeah. That's not even fucking words.
Uncomfortable. Car. Shop at Fred Kroger.
It sounds very uncomfortable.
It does.
It's almost like, I feel like Freddy Krueger is Jackie Earl Haley's version.
Yeah.
Of Freddy Krueger. Where he's like, blah, blah, blah,
blah. I'm Freddy Krueger.
Well, he used to do that all the time back in the day where
yeah.
I'd be like, I'm Freddy Krueger. I'll remember you.
Odd manner of speaking.
All right.
No, but if the first movie was designed to make you feel vulnerable you know, and yeah. feel like you're put in a position where you can't really run from what scares you. This one, the reason I keep saying uncomfortable is because it is. Watch this movie. You'll no go shit. You'll go back and forth between laughing your ass off at the most ridiculous dialogue or awkward.
I think I know what movie scared the shit out of it.
No, it's that's the thing.
Oh, no.
Let me be clear. I don't think I could be
uncomfortable.
I don't think I could be any more clear about this. Let me finally straighten this out. The first movie scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
The second one made me uncomfortable.
I think I got it. Well, that was Nightmare
it's
too.
It's the lighting and the audio.
I'm trying. I'm like,
it's not the homosexuality.
No, I don't. I was, you know, probably 8-10 years old. I wasn't thinking about any of that stuff. I was sure. just.
Maybe you're thinking that maybe you should start thinking.
Yeah,
about it.
Yeah, I should. Yeah.
No, I. You know, yeah. Like I said, to me as a film, it's an interesting time capsule.
Yeah.
It's one of those things where you're kind of like, how much of this did they know?
Yeah.
You know, and how much of it was just a happy accident?
Yeah.
But it doesn't matter because either way it works.
Yeah, it
works
does.
Very well.
Either way, it was uncomfortable.
It succeeds at being very uncomfortable. This conversation is making me uncomfortable. Let's move on. Nightmare on Elm Street 3.
Yeah, The Dream Warriors.
Yep.
Incredible film, also not directed by Craven, but it's kind of solidified Freddy Krueger as the kind of tentpole horror icon we know yeah. him as. You know, it's when he started getting a little quippier.
It's the beginning dark. Of the Nightmare on Elm Street series slowly descending into shit.
Is this the one where they're all in a mental hospital?
Yes.
Yep, yep.
I did see that one.
You did see that one.
Yeah.
See, to me, this is the beginning of the MTV Freddy Krueger.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
like real
the pop culture.
Dokken. Yeah. He's like, I listen to Dokken and shit like that, yeah. you know. Like, I don't know. I saw the MTV special that Freddy Krueger hosted once, and it was incredible. Incredible. Right alongside Freddy Krueger's Greatest Hits album that he put out, which was basically a terrible cover band assembled singing pop versions of songs that just had Dream in the title. Mm. And then Robert Englund on a microphone going, ha! You're dreaming! Like at random intervals. It is hilarious. You should look it up if you can find it. Freddy's Greatest Hits.
This makes me believe that, you know, as a side note to what we do with the bad music video panel,
yeah.
probably need to include some of the Freddy rap video
oh,
stuff
it's incredible.
In there.
He like, does we got to get that shit. In there. Anyway, so, but that gives you a good sense of this character kind of in a weird way becoming much larger than life. Like, it started off as this scary horror thing, right? And then by the end of it, they were like Freddy bobbleheads and like Freddy rap albums. And like Robert Englund, bless his fucking soul, is just running around like, you know, I gotta ride this fucking Freddy wave while it's here. And just recently, he put up photos and announced that he was going to be in an episode of The Goldbergs playing Freddy Krueger.
That's bizarre.
Full makeup and
everything. But yeah, because he said that last makeup tour was it for him.
Yeah.
I guess
but he did
the
it.
Goldbergs were able it. To get him back into it.
And he you know, he looks a little bit like Bela Lugosi looked near the
crispy.
End of Dracula.
Is he starting to look kind of rough?
Starting to look.
Have they done some promotional photos yet?
Oh yeah, they're out there. They're out there. You should find them.
I'm gonna look that shit up right now.
Look, I mean, I mean, no disrespect. I love Freddy Krueger. I love Robert Englund. I'm a big fan. You know, but there's
so
times
if
they're you see, it, like maybe this should be over.
They did get in Halloween. They did get the gentleman who was wearing the gear.
Nick Castle.
They got Nick Castle to play him when he's wearing the mask. The gentleman, the bald guy, that's a different guy.
Yeah.
In those scenes. But any other instance where you see Michael Myers wearing the mask in the 2018
right.
brand new, that's Nick Castle.
Yes, it is.
Do you think that if there were some sort of way that they tried to retcon, same way, Nightmare on Elm Street and take it to the sequel, direct sequel to the first movie.
Okay.
Do you think it would be a tremendous mistake to put him back in the makeup and try and do that character again?
No. And let me tell you why. Because the original character description was of a man in his late 60s. Mm-hmm. So he can do that. And it would work.
I was pretty disappointed when they didn't use him for the remake.
Really? Mm-hmm. So tell me, how did you feel about the remake?
I was prissy.
I was sitting prissy about it. Yeah. You want to hear some of that priss? That was the most happy accident I've ever heard. I loved it. What would your review of 2010 Nightmare on Elm Street be? Prissy! Sorry. So what did you think of 2010 Nightmare on Elm Street?
I liked it. I liked that it went a little bit more in depth with the backstory. Yeah. I was just disappointed that it wasn't the Freddy that I came to know and love for so many years.
Yeah. Look, Jackie Earle Haley crushed playing Freddy Krueger. He crushes everything. But he wasn't my Freddy Krueger. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? I feel like that's what you're saying.
Yeah, I feel like if you replace the person who plays Michael Myers, I mean, they're so in a costume that it doesn't matter.
Right.
While Freddy has lots of makeup and stuff, there's certain physical facial characteristics
yep.
that are still different.
Robert Englund brings that character to life.
Yeah.
Now, Wes Craven made that character, so he's half responsible. The other half is Robert Englund.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and yeah. you can see that because he carries that film series by himself.
Mm-hmm. Body language has a lot to do with how a lot of these characters right. play out. And that's part of why I think that the new Halloween works, is because there's a familiarity to the way that Nick Castle right. operates in that right. suit. Mm-hmm. It's why,
he looms in a very specific way.
When they did yes. that right. Friday the 13th remake, you know, like was almost a decade ago now.
Yeah.
That Jason was a big, lumbering, huge, like Hulk that moved very differently than Jason that we know.
Right.
If you change the actor, the body language is going to change. Jackie Earle Haley has a great, lanky, wiry, kind of uncomfortable set of animations, but they are not Robert Englund.
No,
it's very different.
No. And you have to, at some point, allow the character to become bigger than the actor. Because if you don't, that character is going to die. With the actor. And that was why I was always...
The Phantom of the Opera effect, as Nick kind of calls
it. It's true. You have to allow the Phantom of the Opera to be played by different actors. And it can be anyone of any race, of any religion, of any sexuality. You have... At some point, there's going to have to be a gay Phantom of the Opera. It's going to have to happen. And it should happen. Because you need to have... different boundaries for this story to be told over and over and over.
If you
again.
Don't retell the story, it slips into irrelevance and
it's
becomes,
true.
You know,
now the thing gets forgotten. The reason that I've never been super pissed off about remakes is because if I don't like the version of Phantom that you present to me, it doesn't burn my other copies of it by default, right? Mm-hmm. So just because you come to me and you say, by the way, this is, Middle Eastern Phantom of the Opera. If that's not the one that I'm super down with, or like Dario Argento's Phantom of the Opera, is a good example. His was Phantom of the Opera that was raised in the sewer by rats.
Yeah.
And it's really weird. It is one of the worst films I've ever seen. And it is, he doesn't have a facial deformity. He's just a dude with long blonde hair that's
and
like.
Lots of rats.
Yes. And lots of rats.
So he's
it's
a
true.
Sewer bum.
It's all he is. And he wears like leather pants and purple shirts.
But every generation, you know, if there's something that continues, it's like it's that argument that people have about James Bond.
Yeah,
you got everybody loves their favorite James Bond.
Right.
Batman. I know people who despise, you know, the Batman 66, Adam West Batman.
Oh,
And then people who will in the flip say, I love Batman 66 and Adam West and that whole Batman, that's my Batman,
right.
and anything that came after it is brooding
right.
and dark, and
right.
I hate that shit.
Right.
It just depends on who you're talking
exactly.
to, what generation they're from.
But the point is that that character had the ability to be retranslated over and over and over again in mm-hmm. different ways, shapes, or forms. You know, and I think that you have to be open to allow those different interpretations. I feel like if you... Like I said, my point being, I hated Dario Argento, Phantom of the Opera. I thought it was a terrible film. I watch it to laugh at it. But that's it. Having said that, it doesn't offend me. And the reason for that being because just because that film came out, it didn't burn every other film.
You don't have to watch it.
It's
right.
true. I'm going to complain about one of these. I'm not going to stay on it long because that's not what the show is about.
I'm ready.
But Mary Poppins, the remake.
Yeah.
You're coming in after Julie Andrews. And the only person who could have taken it over is Super Nanny, and they didn't cast her. That's all I'm saying.
No Super Nanny.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
Whatever the fuck that song is. You know, I used to watch Super Nanny all the time, man. I would
amazing.
Sit in my apartment and just watch Super Nanny and eat soup.
So
she's great.
She's great. This is what you're doing wrong with your child. She's dressed as Freddy Krueger in the next episode. Super Nanny. Holy shit.
No, Nightmare on Elm Street's been a recurring thing in mine and Nick's lives. Nick, for the anybody that's heard us do panels might have heard once or twice things like this from the stories, but my brother, we started watching Nightmare on Elm Street movies when we were really young. I mean, really young. And our parents were kind of like unapologetic about it. I mean, now, like, it was pretty normal then to watch horror movies and slash movies. Now, if you let a 6-year-old watch Nightmare on Elm Street, people might accuse you of abuse. You know what I mean?
Right, and that's right.
It's kind of a strange time we're living in. But we would watch this stuff. Nick would go to school in kindergarten, and he would draw little Freddy, like crayon Freddy Krueger with blood dripping off of his claws. And my parents would get the PTA meeting calls and be like, you know, we need to sit down and talk about your son. You know, we have this artwork that he's drawing, and we need you to see it. You know, so my parents show up to the school thinking Nick's drawing like people fucking dogs or something, and it's Freddy Krueger. And
my mom's like, Freddy Krueger.
It's Freddy. You know,
and like, he draws Freddy. No.
And they're like, no. And he's like, no, it's okay. It's his favorite movie. He draws it all the time.
That somehow makes it worse. No, it's okay. It's okay. He really likes
it. And that is how Mr. Agitator was born. You know, do you want a Mr. Agitator? Because that's how you get a Mr. Agitator.
Yeah, that's true.
This was ingrained in our youth. And we would go to the video store, VHS, Video City USA, when we were kids and we grew up in Mississippi, and we would rent Nightmare on Elm Street movies over and over
and over.
And I would say, starting with Nightmare on Elm Street 3, we watched that one in circles. You know, and three, four, and five, I feel like we watched
I liked five a lot when I was a kid. It's not everyone's favorite. It's very gothic. It's very misunderstood. And I think it's kind of a little gem.
Weird movie.
Yeah, I liked it, though. I thought it was different.
And it's different, too, because it follows characters. This thing started in 3, where there was a passing of the torch to characters.
It was like every 2 movies or so.
They switched characters, which is, you don't really see a lot of horror franchises it that way.
Not anymore.
Usually they kind of get rid of everybody except for whoever the final person is in the movie, and then they put new people around them. And they did a little bit of that in 5 from 4, but I don't know.
What I want to tie back together, though, is Wes Craven's New Nightmare. That's the other Nightmare film directed by Wes Craven. What a fucking brilliant movie, and very overlooked. It is a pre-Scream, self-aware meta film.
Meta movie, and meta before meta was popular.
Right, meta before meta was anything, really. To my recollection, the first true, like, mainstream meta film was Scream, where it was very self-aware, where it understood the genre it was making fun of, where it, but at the same time celebrating it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But Wes Craven's New Nightmare is like a pre-version of that.
Yeah, it's a prototype.
And are you familiar with Wes Craven's New Nightmare?
I've seen it. I would have to get some details.
So it's not a Nightmare on Elm Street movie, but it is.
It's 10 years after the original Nightmare on Elm Street. This film came out in 1994. In this film, Robert Englund is playing Robert Englund, and Freddy Krueger is a character coming out of the film to kill them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which is weird.
And the actress who played Nancy, Heather Langenkamp,
is playing a fictitious version of herself. And, you know, she has, like, a son and her husband
is a special effects guy that's working on the new gloves, like an animatronic glove.
Which is, in real life, her husband is a special effects guy, and she helps him work on movies and stuff.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of really interesting touches like that.
Yeah. And Freddy looks exceptionally
handsome.
Demonic. like Freddy,
charming.
Freddy looked in the other movies like he was supposed to be burnt. Like Freddy was supposed to look.
Right.
This looks, and based on the way that the movie plays out, you could almost kind of wonder whether or not it's like a demon or a Satan taking the form of Freddy Krueger.
No, they're pretty implicit. I mean?
Yeah.
They're pretty, you know, it's implied, but it's also very heavily implied at one point that this is not Freddy Krueger, the fictitious character.
It's Freddy Krueger.
It's Freddy Krueger.
It's Freddy Krueger.
The grocer. He's, you know, like, I gotta get you some green.
Clean up on aisle 2.
Knives are still in aisle 12.
That's right.
Cutlery.
God, taste.
No, this is Freddy Krueger. No, this is a demon.
So what was different visually about him than usual?
He looked more feral.
Yeah,
he looks like
darker.
Almost more kind of primal. And they did this interesting thing where instead of him looking burned, any of the exposed skin parts almost look like, you know, muscle fiber and sinew.
Right.
And there's a lot of, like, interlaced bone between the
muscles. Right, like his glove is not a glove as much as it's like a bone.
An extension of bone. Yeah, yeah. He looks just more,
a fucking demon.
He looks more animalistic. And there's something in the way that they did his eyes where he looks very different, too.
Right. It's like if you imagined a demon watched Nightmare on Elm Street and was just like, I like that.
Hey,
I'm going to do something like that.
It's like Ray from the Ghostbusters where they're like, you choose the final form.
Oh,
it's
God.
Like a demon going, you know what? That guy's fucked up. I'm going to take that form when I terrorize everybody.
Yeah.
And so there's a different look to him. And the movie's really weird. And there's a lot of, like, you know, subversive things that they try to make symbolic toward the end. And they kind of try to marry a few things that don't work. It's funny because the movie and the idea behind the movie are far more interesting than the execution, because it's actually kind of a boring movie until it's not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There are some disturbing scenes.
It's definitely
scenes
a film
too.
Of suspense and build up.
And Freddie looks good, amazing, though. Too. They do something with him in this movie they didn't do in any of the others. He's wearing these, like, kind of like combat boots, and he's got this black trench coat that he wears with his traditional attire that somehow makes him look really imposing.
Yeah, no, he's a very, very fucking imposing.
And I mean, and Robert Englund played him just like he did in previous movies, all the campy ones,
yeah.
too, but he
just
moves.
Darker.
He was a lot darker, like an animalistic.
Yeah,
you know,
he wasn't as there were no wisecracks, really. You know, there were a couple of little moments, but, you know, I don't know. It was just a much darker film, and it was interesting. It was to me a little bit more about the lines between fantasy and reality blurring, mm-hmm. and how being an actor is a kind of a tough job. And mm-hmm. there was like this whole idea of stalkers and like. The things in the business that people don't really talk about. Now, that'll wrap together once again in Scream. So, you know, Wes Craven's New Nightmare, very interesting film. Yeah, so John.
I'm showing Kizzy a picture of what New Nightmare Freddy. He just, doesn't he have like a look about him?
Mm-hmm.
He looks a lot
darker.
More intense.
Yeah, he does look less burned and somehow more,
muscly.
Yeah, muscly.
Yeah. So, you know, after the Nightmare on Elm Street series, Wes Craven kind of focused on some romantic comedies, even made a few horror films in between that were not as well received, like Shocker, which was, whoa, it was rough.
Shocker.
It was pretty bad. And also another film that I personally enjoyed, but was also strange, and that was People Under the Stairs.
That movie is so fucking bizarre.
It's a weird movie, and it's actually ahead of its time in a lot of ways. He followed that up also with The Serpent and the Rainbow, which was another strange film. It was adapted from a book. Mm-hmm. And some of it works, and some of it doesn't. But that's my point. He kind of seemed to have a bunch of swings and misses after Nightmare, and people seemed to kind of be like, well, you know, he did his thing, Nightmare on Elm Street. And then, like a fucking 800-pound gorilla just decimated the industry with Scream.
I will never forget when we saw Scream.
I know. It was
everybody.
It was like a cinema changed.
It did. And everybody at the end of that movie, people were cheering and clapping. And when we all walked out of the theater, it's the kind of movie like you don't see shit like that happen anymore. Because
especially
people are so
in
jaded.
Horror movies.
Yeah.
Especially in horror movies.
People were like invigorated by that movie.
Yeah.
They were so blown away by it.
The whole time. We were legitimately sitting there going, who's the killer? The killer could be anybody. Legitimately could be anybody.
Yeah.
You know? What was your experience with it when you first saw it?
It's hard to recall that first time because since then I saw it so many times.
Yeah.
It was a favorite movie of mine. Yeah, so that first impression, it's hard to say. You know, it's just so ingrained in my head now that it was, what's his face from 13 Ghosts?
Oh, Matthew Lillard.
Yeah.
That's a whole other podcast.
Hey, Billy, man, I think I'm dying.
He has nailed his, like, drool and cry, and he uses it in everything he's in now. He used it in Twin Peaks recently. Like,
did he really?
Yeah.
He was just like, I got that fucking, I got that
people
stew
really
cry.
Responded well to that, so
I gotta rev it up. Yeah. You know, what a great film. What interesting choices and what great callbacks to legendary horror films, like Billy's last name being Loomis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Brilliant. I love it. Or the scene, like, you know, this film was so meta that there was even a scene in it where the actor, Jamie Kennedy, is sitting on the couch watching Halloween. And they're using the score from the VHS that he's watching as the score for the film, for Scream. Mm-hmm. And the killer is standing behind Jamie Kennedy while he's screaming at Jamie Lee Curtis's character, "Jamie, it's behind you."
Uh-huh.
And in real life, the actor's name is Jamie and the killer's behind him?
Yeah.
Jesus Christ, is that like five layers of meta? There's all these little things. You know, it's crazy.
Yeah.
Like, what film put that much work or time into
that movie? Is
like
still
that?
Fun to watch. Even though you know how it ends now, that movie was still fun to watch. And I remember a sense of when the ending kind of starts to ramp up and you figure out who the killers are in Scream. Everybody was really uncomfortable because you're like, this is just the worst form of betrayal.
Yeah. No, it was fucked up.
This is fucking terrible.
Right.
But then subsequent Scream movies came, and then we just don't talk about those because they're terrible.
I'm going to disagree
with you. I enjoyed Scream 2, Scream 3. I know there's Scream 4. It doesn't stick in my memory, though.
I liked Scream 4. I like Scream 4.
Scream
a lot.
4 is actually better than anything that came between Scream 1 and 4.
Maybe
so
I just
2
didn't
and 3
see
not
it.
So great.
Once again,
3 is fucking unwatchable.
No, see was, I'm going to argue about 3 for one specific reason. A fucking powerful reason. Do you remember Scream 3?
I wish I didn't, but
it's
I do.
On the college campus.
No, that was
no,
Scream 2.
That's Scream 2.
Yeah. Scream 3 was the one that took place in Hollywood.
Yeah.
Right. So that's like an extra level of meta.
So let me ask you a question. Who financed the Scream films?
I actually don't know.
You don't know?
No.
What company released it?
It was New Line Cinema.
No.
It wasn't?
Nope.
Who did it?
It's Dimension.
Oh, that's true.
And who ran Dimension? The Weinsteins.
Mm.
Harvey Weinstein ran Dimension. What was the plot of Scream 3 again?
Oh, no.
How a company producer rapes Sydney's mother along with a bunch of other studio executives, causing the psychotic break in her son, who is the first Scream killer. Right?
Oof.
Did Wes Craven take the financing of a rapist to make a movie that mocked said rapist and flew it right under the radar?
I hope so.
I had not even considered that in light
holy
of the Harvey Weinstein shit.
Shit.
All right, well, now I've got to go back and watch this movie that
holy
I thought was bad.
Fucking shit.
Man.
Is that a Me Too fucking film about 20 years
20 years
before
Me Too? Maybe.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
That's genius.
Mm.
It's brilliant. And,
well,
you know,
make an argument for Scream 2. Can't be
no
done.
Argument for that shit.
It can't.
There was more screen time for Jamie Kennedy, and I enjoyed that.
Yeah,
true. So then he gets stabbed in a van.
I know it's a good thing they gave him more screen time.
You come get me, you pussy! Oh, I'm blah, 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 dead.
Yeah.
And then Freddy Krueger gets out.
Yeah. Hey, let me put it to you like this: after the first Scream, the Scary Movie, like,
oh yeah,
those scary were movie. Better Scream movies than Scream after the first one. But
no, go back and watch Scream 3 again with a very modern look at things.
Yeah.
And knowing that Harvey Weinstein was the head of Dimension.
That's just insane.
And you will
I
walk
didn't even
away
think about
going,
that.
So did Wes Craven know something? Like many
no,
the-
dude, man, a lot of people have come out subsequently and said it was always there. People talked about it. They just
exactly.
didn't talk about it.
Like many in the industry. Did this guy know something? And he worked an entire film and had the fucking guy pay for an anti-studio exec rape movie. How fucking subversive is that? That's art. That's insane.
Mm-hmm.
That's a statement. Is the movie perfect? Fuck no. Does it fall apart in ways? Sure. Is there a message there? Absolutely.
Should it be the next remake? Possibly.
Possibly. Right. The next Scream is just they pull the mask out. It's just Harvey Weinstein. You know? You're going to die tonight. So Harvey, get off the phone.
Yeah.
See, Scream 4 had some good moments in it. I'll be honest with you. It's the only thing Emma Roberts has ever been in that I thought she was pretty damn good in that role. But the problem is it set the pace for her. It set the pace for her.
Really?
Yeah. Where she played kind of like this aggressive, bitchy.
Oh, no. Scream Queens.
Yeah.
Scream Queens, the TV show.
Scream 4 come out? I'm not a huge fan of Emma Roberts.
See, I don't like her either, but she was good in that.
As many weren't
that I would remember.
So in 2010, Scream 4 came out. Now Wes Craven actually directed all four Scream films. Just putting that out there too. Unlike the Nightmare series, this was his baby. He saw all of them through, mm-hmm. including the fourth. Now, the fourth was very much a statement against remakes. So it was meta about being remade. Mm-hmm. So Emma Roberts' character was like the new Sydney. Mm. Emma Roberts' character ended up playing, I think it's Sydney's cousin or something like that. Yeah, it's like her aunt's daughter. So it was like her cousin, right? So, you know, and she's young and she's in that age. She has brown hair. And she's, at the time, people didn't really know who Emma Roberts was. And she hadn't been typecast as the crazy bitch character yet. Mm-hmm. Right? So she was playing a very good girl. She was clearly in line to be the next hero.
Mm-hmm.
Come to find out at the end, she's the fucking killer and the mastermind of all of it. Huh. And she's a little psycho.
Yeah, she plays great psycho at the end, and I think has subsequently been typecast into playing a real kind of like steely bitch. Yeah, she's always mean in everything she's in.
The other film, the other show that she was in that I loved was Scream Queens, and she was fantastic in it. Hilarious. It's the same guy that does American Horror Story, mm-hmm. and it's a little bit more of a teen-centric.
I think they just canceled it, too.
They canceled it like a year ago. The second season was horrible.
I really didn't enjoy her role in American Horror Story. I didn't either. I didn't watch it. And then, it wasn't until after that that I saw her little face up there on Hulu for Scream Queens.
She was actually great in it because the character was written for her, and she plays the ultimate asshole. Like, and she does it with such conviction and humor. Like, it's legitimately a very funny show. It's a horror show, I guess, but it's also kind of like Scream, a murder mystery, but it's also very much a comedy, and I fell in love with it. I thought it was fun, and by the end of the season, I was genuinely curious as to who the killer was. And at the same time, when they wrapped the final episode of the first season up, I was satisfied 100%. Didn't think the show had to come back. It came back for one more season afterwards, and it was terrible. But that first season is an incredible horror story. And also, Jamie Lee Curtis is in it. And she's great. She's absolutely great. And it's she's hilarious. Like I said, if you like horror stuff and stuff that's kind of... It's very Scream-based, self-satirical... That show is absolutely funny from start to finish. You know, there were moments I was quoting nonstop from it, you know, and it's very self-aware, and that really works in its favor. I was kind of sad that more people didn't pick up on it because I thought it was, as a horror fan, I thought it was very deserving.
Maybe I'll check it out.
Did you watch the MTV kind of reboot of Scream when they made it into a TV series?
I watched every episode.
No.
How was it?
Really good.
Because I actually skipped it. I haven't seen it.
It was really good.
Yeah,
it was different. It was not at all based on the films. The killer was kind of redesigned, and they kind of gave his mask a backstory and stuff.
He looked more serious. I remember
a little bit.
You know, he wasn't as goofy looking.
Right. So they kind of redid it, but surprisingly, it really worked. I heard that they canceled it, and that's okay. They had two seasons, and they were good seasons. And the end of the second season ended in such a weird way that I thought it was okay to let it go at that point. But I actually truly enjoyed it. I thought it was Scream for this
Did
generation.
Did Wes Craven have anything to do with that, or was that after he died?
I'm pretty sure it was before he died, and I'm pretty sure he had
probably like an executive producer credit or something.
Yeah, and I think he actually was involved to an extent that he approved, you know, and that's enough, you know. Yeah. But it was actually a good show. I wanted to hate it. Just because my old man self wanted to kind of be like, hey, these kids today know about Scream. They don't know anything. But I actually liked it. I actually enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I had no idea that they made it into a TV show.
They did.
Nowadays, you can do TV, and it's pretty visceral.
Yeah.
And it actually works. Like, some of the shit in that show was probably more disturbing than what was in the film. Mm. You know? It worked pretty well.
You know, Wes Craven did a lot, but he had some things that you wouldn't realize that he directed, or some real turds.
He made some bad ones.
He did a movie in 1989 called Shocker.
Yeah, I just talked about it.
I know, but I'm saying, No, no, no. With that,
are you aware that he did Shocker?
No, no. But
are you shocked?
This I'm was a shocked. Movie that I talked about. Nick and I going to the video store and picking things out. We eventually got through almost every horror movie in the store.
Yeah,
and we came
yeah.
when Shocker we came across bad. Shocker. It was Nick and I were mesmerized at how bad it was. When
oh,
we
it's
kids.
Pretty bad. It's pretty bad.
Yeah. Vampire in Brooklyn.
Yeah,
starring Eddie Murphy. Yep. Yeah, which is actually kind of like a comedy. Sort
yeah,
of. Like a like I think of like a Mel Brooks.
I'm gonna tell you, it wasn't funny.
It's not funny at all.
I remember that much about it.
Cursed, which was just fucking terrible.
God. So Cursed had Jesse Eisenberg and Christina Ricci,
mm-hmm.
and it was a werewolf movie that he made, and it was not good.
It was a movie.
It was kind of like if you like the seminal 2000s werewolf movie was Ginger Snaps. And it's like okay. if you took Ginger Snaps and took everything away from it that was good,
mm-hmm.
it would be kind of that. It would be Cursed.
Gratuitous sex scene.
I don't. Was there a sex scene in? I don't think there was one sex scene in any of them.
So. No,
but it was. Cursed was shit.
Yeah. But that's it. You know, the as far as the horror stuff goes, I mean, Wes Craven had a pretty storied career, not just as a director, but as a writer.
Yeah, his contributions as a producer. Are incredible.
He did a lot of different things. And it seems like he got away with more outside of his directing. He got to work in other projects where people didn't really care because they weren't really putting his name on it as the master of horror. So he kind of, I think maybe he got his fixes elsewhere. But by and large, you know, the guy had this crazy career. I mean, Nick and I have known Wes Craven's name since we were kids.
Oh, yeah.
You know, he was one of the ones we always knew
like,
his name.
Stephen King or Clive Barker.
Wes Craven. Yeah.
John Carpenter.
John Carpenter. Who, by the way, I didn't talk about in the Halloween podcast, but man, did he kill the fucking music with his son or what? For the score for Halloween 2018.
Oh, yeah.
God, it was incredible.
Yeah, it was great. The timing was perfect. At the beginning, there was some more modern-sounding elements, but the second that Michael came back on screen and his stuff, it got perfect cues for the old music.
I thought it worked really well. Anyway, Wes Craven, he did some pretty crazy stuff, but what I think really impressed me about his career, the thing that I like about it the most, is he didn't need approval. Like, he just did what he wanted to do. And that's, I think, a very powerful thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, you can... if you stand there and you wait too long to make your vision come true, you're not going to make anything. Mm-hmm. If you worry about what other people are going to think about what you're releasing endlessly, you're never going to move forward. You will always find a reason for something to not be right. So, like, you know... I see people do this all the time in music or in any kind of artistic medium where they're like, well, I don't have the right kind of microphone to do this, so I can't record it. Okay. I don't have the right kind of mixing board, so it's not going to sound good enough to release. Yeah, I think Ray Charles recorded it in a can, and we're still listening to it 50 fucking years later.
Yeah.
So I don't think that has anything to do with anything. I think that the reality is if you sit on your hands and you're like, well, you know, I'm going to wait for the time to be right, you're never making anything.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So you can't do that. And what I liked about Wes Craven was here was a guy in his late 30s who could have said, well, I'm a teacher and I have a family. It's too late for me to do that. And then we would have been deprived of all of this great entertainment, this great art that the guy ended up crafting in his lifetime and his career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he wouldn't have gotten to get his message out there. He wouldn't have gotten to make his art or tell his truth.
And he's kind of unique amongst the people who produced a lot of horror movies in their time because a lot of these guys tried to make other sort of, you know, horror movies or horror characters. Look at, you know, John Carpenter's Ghosts of Mars.
Whoa.
That movie's unfucking watchable.
That's pretty
bad. It was an original idea of his. You know, it's not Halloween, you know what I mean? And then you look at, like, what else did Sean S. Cunningham make outside of Friday the 13th? And a lot of people don't realize this, but he's kind of really only responsible for the original, you know, Jason, you know, that has the burlap sack on his head.
Right.
He's not really the purveyor of the hockey mask guy after a point.
Yeah, the hockey mask didn't appear until the
third movie. Yeah.
And even then, that was like primarily the costume designer and the, like the
yeah,
department.
It wasn't really. He created the concept for Jason more than he did anything. But Wes Craven is unique in that he made several different horror franchises. Some were better than others, obviously, but he had success with two franchises, Nightmare on Elm Street and Scream. Yeah. And most of massive these guys success. That tried to do more than one, the one character they're really known for, it did not work. It right. didn't work. And he's unique in that way because he had success more than once.
Well, and I think a lot of that, once again, comes down to what we were just saying. Like, he didn't wait for the, you know, the right time. He just did it.
Yeah.
You just make it. You put it out there and people will respond how they respond.
And it seems like he learned from his mistakes too.
Yeah, I think so.
He improved his formulas and the ideas.
Well, you look
him.
At Wes Craven's New Nightmare to the first Scream and it's like a light, it's like a leap, man. Mm-hmm. A huge leap. It's light years ahead. But it's the same idea. But one of them is a little more amateurishly crafted by comparison. The other one's a brilliant film, you know? So I don't know. I'm a big believer in that. And I think that that's probably, in my opinion, the thing that really set his career apart from a lot of his contemporaries was that he was a lot older. He could have just said, well, I'm done. You know, I didn't get a chance to do that. Yeah. But it's also inspiring and it's honest that no matter what your age is, no matter where you're sitting in your life, every day is a chance for you to turn it around and go do something that you want to do and present to the world yourself as you think you are or as you could envision yourself in the future, not necessarily who you're bound to at the moment. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of a powerful idea, and we overlook it a lot of times, you know, but all art, the things that we listen to, the things that we watch, the movies that we watch, they come from somewhere. Mm-hmm. They don't just materialize and make themselves, you know, like... you can't just go get it from Freddy Krueger. Like, you know, Freddy Krueger, where do I get my new album? Yeah. You know? But I don't know. I just feel like that's kind of a cool thing in his career that always stuck out to me. So, unfortunately, Wes Craven passed. So, rest in peace.
This was 2014, wasn't it? Or 2015?
I think it was 2015.
2015,
yeah. Yeah, I believe so.
Wasn't it cancer?
I think so, yeah. The thing that kills 99% of us, you know, is a lot of cancer out there.
Yeah.
Horrible. But, yeah, that's, you know, the man will be missed.
What a legacy, though.
But, what a legacy he left, and, you know, he didn't give up. So.
It's not something I don't know if I've ever actually kind of publicly said it in anything we've done, podcasts or, you know, panels or anything, but Freddy Krueger is actually my favorite of the like horror movie slasher type characters over Michael Myers, over Jason, over
me too.
Anybody, he is easily my favorite for a lot. He's so different than any other character. He's so imposing in a way that makes you feel helpless.
Makes you
I dig it. He's
uncomfortable.
Cool. Maybe.
Does Freddy Krueger make you uncomfortable?
In like the back of a Volkswagen?
Oh god. Well, I'm Mr. Agitator, lead singer-songwriter for V is for Villains.
I'm Fallon Flynn. I play guitars and do backup vocals.
Kizzy Chaos, synth and backup vocals.